Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. This is a very impressive turnout of people paying to eat and listen to a talk about famine. So we applaud your contradictory impulses. Before I introduce our speaker today, just a few club announcements. We hope that you are also interested in attending a few upcoming events here. Next Tuesday, we have John Sayre from Oxfam Hong Kong, whose talk is going to be about China's unscrupulous. And then later in the month, on November 23rd, we have the famous Basil Powell, who is going to be presenting a photo essay of great landscapes from around the world. So we hope you all sign up for that as well. Our guest for today, however, pardon me, our guest for today, Frank DeCotter. is the chair professor of humanities at the University of Hong Kong. He is also a respected China scholar who will give us a presentation that is just a timely reminder that for all the progress that has brought many of us to live in this part of the world that we see in China today, there, of course, is a somewhat traumatic past that deserves to be remembered and to be understood better. So Frank's book, I think, sheds some light on that period, and we hope that he'll share some of that book with you today. It's probably best that he do it after everybody has finished eating. As I understand, some of the details are not terribly pleasant. Frank is also a professor on leave from the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. Frank, please come up and address the crowd. And just a gentle reminder to please keep your cell phones turned to silent.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here, and for more than one reason. One reason is that the FCC is my favorite venue here in Hong Kong. The second reason is that I've been asked over the past months to give lunch talks on a number of occasions. And this is the first time I've actually been given lunch before the talk, which is very nice. It's difficult to talk about famine when you see everybody else munch through their lunch. So thank you very much for that. Mao's Great Famine. Of course, we all know that there was a famine between 1958 and 1962. So when I started digging around in Communist Party archives, a few years ago, after arriving here in Hong Kong, I would do something very simple. I'd take a little train from Kowloon Railway Station to Guangzhou, and at about 9:40 in the morning, I would be reading archives in the Guangdong Provincial Archives. I thought, this is a great topic. Let me read on it. I was taken aback by what I encountered. I believed, rather naively perhaps, that famine was about people not having enough food. But what I found on day one of my research, which subsequently would take me to dozens of party archives, I spent about 6 months in total going through county archives, municipal archives, and most of all, provincial archives in dozens of locations. What I found on day one and subsequently as well is extraordinary levels of violence. Here was a report, the first one I read, written by an investigation team that went to Luoding County in Guangdong Province in 1960. What did they found? They found that hundreds of people were forced to strip bare in the middle of the winter and work on irrigation sites. Some of them died of cold. They found that a boy who had spoken out at a meeting, aged 12, was locked up in a hog's cage. Another child was tied up and chucked into a pond for not working hard enough. extraordinary. Province after province, place after place, there seemed to be so much violence. People were covered in excrement, forced to drink urine. People had their ears chopped off. People were buried alive. People were branded with sizzling tools like animals. In the case of Wang Qiyou, that was reported to the top leadership. Here's a man who had his legs tied up with iron wire. Somebody dumped a 10-kilo stone on his back. His ear was chopped off, and then he was branded with a sizzling tool like an animal. All that for having stolen a potato. In one case in Hunan province, a man was forced by the local cadre in charge, a man called Xiong Zhechang, to bury his own 8-year-old child alive because this kid had walked away from the canteen with a handful of grain in his pocket. The father died of grief 3 weeks later. How do I explain this level of violence? That was the first issue I was confronted with. Well, it seems to me that when you start collectivizing everything, when you start following Mao's vision of creating one giant army, turning every farmer into a soldier, so that you can deploy that great labor force that counted in the hundreds of millions in one continuous revolution, tackling one task after another in order to catapult the country forward, to bypass its competitors, in particular the Soviet Union. Once you start doing that, once you start treating people like soldiers and you collectivize everything, you divide men and women into different dormitories, you put children into kindergartens, you take away a man's land, his home, his tools, his cattle, his livelihood. Well, what you're basically doing is stripping away every incentive to work. When the cultivator no longer has any land that belongs to himself and knows very well that even if he works hard and earns enough work points, he will not get fed properly in the canteen, and most of the grain that he produces will be taken away by the state, well, why do anything at all? Yet, on the other hand, the cadres on the ground have to fulfill and over-fulfill ever-increasing quotas that they are handed by the top leadership. They have to whip up that workforce in one campaign after the other. Villagers and cadres become locked in a mounting spiral of violence where the whip has to be used to get famished farmers back into the fields. But something else happened in these archives, namely that I discovered quite soon that the major instrument in the arsenal of horror deployed by a few to inflict pain and humiliation on the many was not actually the stick. It was something else. Food. The second discovery here. People didn't die of hunger because there was no food. People were deliberately starved to death. Food was used as a weapon, after all, since everything was collectivized in the countryside. Since the only place where you could get a meal was the canteen, where food was dished out by the spoonful according to merit, it became a very powerful weapon to get rid of people who were considered to be too weak, too vulnerable, too sick to actually perform their duties. This is a state that treated human beings like mere digits on a balance sheet, a resource to be exploited in the name of the greater good, like coal or like grain. It was a very easy, logical extension from these very grisly calculations to start deliberately eliminating people who couldn't perform well enough. What you see in archives is document after document, some of them written by the Public Security Bureau, others written by very powerful provincial party committees, that discover that in some counties in Sichuan, up to 80% of the people were deliberately starved to death. In other words, women who were pregnant, men who were too old to come out, people who were sick, children were deliberately starved in order to increase the food supply for those who contributed to the regime through their own labor. It goes back to a saying by a man called Lenin. He who does not work shall not eat. he who does not work shall not eat. That is very much the underlying principle of that period. And not only that, but people who spoke out, people who fell asleep during a meeting, people who somehow were considered to be rightists or too rich or too bourgeois, were deliberately banned from the canteen and starved to death. Now, overall, how many people died unnecessarily during this period? So far, the estimate we have is about 30 to 32 million unnecessary deaths from 1958 to 62. But all of these estimates, however careful they are, have been based on official statistics published by the People's Republic of China. What I found in these archives at county level, at provincial level, is a whole series of very detailed investigations, often carried out by the Public Security Bureau officers themselves, right in the aftermath of this catastrophe, 1962, 63, 64. And by comparing these statistics that have never been published with the official material, there is an extraordinary gap, which means that I increase it by about 50%, which means that at least 45 million people died unnecessarily during this period. Chen Yizi, a man who was charged by Zhao Ziyang to go through the archives before the massacre at Tiananmen in 1989, Chu went to the archives, and he too found that roughly 45 million people died during that period. So the two estimates based on archives is much higher than all the estimates we have based on official statistical material. Take Pol Pot. 1.7 to 2 million people worked to death, starved to death, or deliberately killed. Take Pol Pot and multiply that by 20, and you will get roughly near what happened in China from 1958 to 1962. You'll get that very roughly. About 6 to 8% of these victims were deliberately killed, buried alive, tortured to death. That means 2 to 3 million people who died a violent death during this period. This must constitute one of the greatest crimes against humanity of the 20th century, ranking on the par with what happened under Adolf Hitler and what happened under Joseph Stalin. It must be the greatest man-made catastrophe in human history. And not just the destruction of human beings. Take housing, for instance. Radical collectivization had extraordinarily destructive effects. Liu Shaoqi, number two, writes in a confidential letter after having investigated the province where he was born, Hunan. He writes to Mao Zedong, and he reports that 40% of all the housing in that province was destroyed during the Great Leap Forward. Similar figures emerged for other places. Why? Well, first, houses were destroyed and turned into rubble to create fertilizer in order to contribute to these extraordinary output figures for agriculture. Then, occasionally, a local leader could see communism beckoning ahead, a better future with skyscrapers. So why not just destroy all the houses we have? Of course, nothing ever got rebuilt. Houses were taken also in order to punish people when they didn't deliver enough grain. Overall, that must constitute a level of destruction that is greater than any of the Second World War bombing campaigns. Nature also savaged in the pursuit of higher output. 50% of the forest coverage probably lost in a great many of provinces. Extraordinary levels of pollution. Irrigation projects that destroyed the local topography, creating landslides, river silting, erosions, land salinization. The transportation system that creaks to a halt before it collapses altogether. In Hunan province, over 100,000 tons of grain has been collected and is waiting by the roadside in 1960. There isn't enough fuel. There aren't enough trucks to come around to collect it. In Zhengzhou railway station, the rail manager decides to dig a ditch about 3 meters deep. Stuff that arrives is just dumped into it. Concrete, machinery, rubber, cotton, there's nobody there to collect it, and it can't be distributed for free. It disappears into a black hole. This is a catastrophe of great proportion. This is the whole collapse of the social and political system on which Mao had staked his prestige. What else does the book do? Well, it also tries to piece together what happened at the very top in the corridors of power with the very ordinary experiences of people. It shows, on the one hand, thanks to all sorts of secret minutes of top leadership meetings, that Mao was perfectly well aware of what was happening. There are a number of smoking guns in the book. It took a while, after all, after the Second World War, to link Hitler to the Holocaust. Well, here too, there have been debates about what Mao really knew. On the 25th of March, 1959, Mao says very clearly to a small gathering of party leaders, go out there, take one third of all the grain. Let half the people die, provided the other half can eat its fill. He who strike first prevails, is the saying he used, meaning that you should go out there, get the grain before the farmers ever get their hands on it. At the lower level, on the ground, ordinary people have to do just about anything in order to survive. And this is another aspect that the book focuses on in great detail, namely the survival techniques deployed by ordinary people in order to stay alive. Farmers have to cheat, hide, pilfer, forage, smuggle, charm, or otherwise outwit the state just in order to survive. They become masters of time theft, trying to work as little as possible. As soon as the local carder is gone, farmers in the countryside dump their tools, sit by the field, and wait for the day to come to an end. They sometimes huddle together in the winter and sleep throughout the winter, if they are allowed to do so by the village chief. But most of all, people steal at every level, at the very top of the political hierarchy, but also at the bottom. Ordinary people try to get away with as much as they can. They eat the grain from the fields before it's even mature, a practice called chiqing in Chinese. They clip off spikes of grain, they husk them in their hands, they eat it without cooking it. At every level, people try to steal as much as they can. These seem to be very much great acts of resistance against the state, but very rapidly, as the moral fabric of the society unravels, as deep starvation sets in, people turn against each other. They steal from their neighbors. They steal from their own families. There are endless reports about fathers turning against their spouses or their own children. Just outside Nanjing, there's a man called Wang Jiuchang, who systematically takes the grain from his 8-year-old daughter, and in the middle of the winter takes a cotton jacket and the trousers. This girl dies of cold and hunger. People are forced by this system to commit unspeakable acts. What I'm trying to say here is that mass destruction goes hand in hand with routine degradations, as ordinary people are forced to make all sorts of horrendous moral compromises. Primo Levi, when he managed to survive Auschwitz, wrote a number of beautiful books. He made it clear that as a survivor of Auschwitz, he was no hero. In his view, the heroes were the ones who had actually shared food. They were dead. They were gone. He pointed out that in order to survive, people had to do all sorts of very difficult things. He called that entire period a gray zone. And I would see this entire period here in China from 1958 to 1962 as one giant gray zone, pretty much also as the black heart of modern Chinese history. And to this day, it seems to me that the People's Republic of China, rather than face it, face this catastrophe and talk about it in order to get out of it, in order to reconstruct some sense of civic behavior and respect for each other and human rights, has been trying to forget it and march ahead without ever looking backwards. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank. We're going to open this up to questions from you all. While you start thinking of them, I'm going to take the speaker's privilege of asking the first one, which is, you describe, Frank, a kind of amorality, a cruelty in the social and political system that I think many people have long associated far more with the Cultural Revolution than they have with the Great Leap Forward. I think the Great Leap Forward is often viewed as just a horrendous policy error that led to led to all these deaths. But I'm wondering, based on your research, how does that change your view of the Cultural Revolution and the degree to which its antecedents were already laid during the Great Leap Forward?
Certainly when it comes to a culture of violence, it seems to me that Red Guards invented very little. The levels of violence during the Great Leap Forward are extraordinary. And I've described a few examples earlier on. This is widespread. It seems to me that the Cultural Revolution would never have happened without the catastrophe of Mao's Great Famine. In my understanding, what happens is that Mao has to step back by 1962 and is extraordinarily resentful of those who, by 1962, start criticizing him for that massive catastrophe. The great Cultural Revolution is his attempt to eliminate every single person who opposed him or criticized him. This attempt to uncover the Khrushchev who denounced Stalin, to get rid of the man who might denounce Mao after his death. But let's face it, every time I walked out of the archives and read a newspaper during those 4 years that I did my research, there seems to be a very odd sort of resonance. Here is an article on people used as slaves in brick factories in Henan. But I was just reading on this in Gansu province about how people were just used as livestock in factories and shipped out when they died. Here this morning is an article about the tainted milk hero being sent to jail. But tainted food goes right back to the Great Leap Forward, when factory bosses are obliged within that system of collectivization and the emphasis on quotas to constantly cut corners, to focus only on the amount of output regardless of quality. The sort of tsipin, the sort of fake products or inferior goods aren't just churned out in China today. This goes again straight back to the Great Leap Forward. What about the whole divide, that creation of a caste of people in the countryside, the divide on the basis of the internal passport system or the hukou system between farmers on the one hand and city dwellers on the other? That goes right back to 1957-58. Or the ability to arrest people and send them to a camp for two, three years without any judgment at all. This is called the Lao Qiao, as opposed to the Lao Gai, re-education through reform rather than labor through reform. There are two dates from this period. So the parallels, the continuities are striking.
Questions?
I look forward to reading your book, Ted Kavouras from Panoramic. I'm curious about your perspective on how this affected the national psyche and how it currently affects the respect or the rule of law in China.
When people are reduced to eating the plaster from their walls, or sometimes to dig a white mud called Guanyin soil in order to fill themselves, when they have to take from their own family members, when just about everybody at every level has to use the system as best as they can just in order to stay alive, it seems to me that creates such a moral hole, if you wish, that it will take a very long time to actually come out of it. And I'm constantly reminded of what happened in Germany. I'm Dutch, by the way, so I can more or less say these things. Although the Dutch apparently are pretty German anyway, like my name. what happened in Germany after the disaster of the Second World War, this constant re-examination of what happened, this constant emphasis on understanding, explaining, remembering. And it seems to me that that effort goes hand in hand with the construction of a civil society. And it seems to me that the exact opposite is happening in the PRC. Let's not look back. Let's forget about it. Let's certainly emphasize what happened during the Cultural Revolution, because that gives political credibility to the regime in power today. But let's not look at that horrendous catastrophe and pretend it never happened. But while you do that, I don't think you will ever be able to truly rebuild some sense of civil society, some sense of respect for each other, some sense of a moral fabric of society that holds it all together.
Next. Here.
I'm Bob Meyer. Jasper Becker also wrote Hungry Ghosts, if I'm not mistaken, and your book is just come out to good reviews, which I'm also looking forward to reading. These are both in English. Following on the question that was just asked, how much of this information is now available in Chinese in China, or do they just dismiss it with the usual pablum that Mao was 70% good and 30% bad?
Jasper Becker did a wonderful book 10 years ago, translated as Uguay in Chinese, and this book will be translated as is currently being translated by Bo Pu, the editor of the Zhao Ziyang memoirs. And I very much hope that it will become available in the mainland. I very much hope, in fact, that it will be pirated and downloaded. I would for once welcome that. But on the other hand, on the other hand, it seems to be such a blatant fact that there is no memorials towards the victims of this period. There's no public memory. There's no Remembrance Day. There's no museum. There's very little, except possibly families trying to keep these memories alive, and occasionally a number of brave historians who, like myself, will do research, but unlike myself, are actually forced to publish outside of their own country because it doesn't go down too well in the People's Republic of China.
I recommend that you have it ready in Chinese translation for the next Hong Kong Book Fair.
I'm just curious about the archives. Firstly, what survived from that period? How much was destroyed? And how much do you think will continue to be available to people like yourself, let alone Chinese researchers?
I think, Martin, that's a crucial question. And I think that what happened in the years leading up to the Olympics is a sense of goodwill and a sense of openness. And combined with that, there is a law that actually says that theoretically any document older than 30 years old can be made available to readers. Now, of course, it's applied in a very random manner. But overall, what I discovered in what I will now describe as a window of opportunity, because I've discovered subsequently that since the Olympics, a lot of material has actually been reclassified. It seems to me that in some occasions, some of these archives simply went too far in making material available, and they've grabbed it back right now. So during that window of opportunity, I would say in some places, up to 70-80% of all the available documentation was actually declassified, great amounts of it. And that would include, for instance, some of these secret leadership speeches, which are normally in the central archives in Beijing, which are still closed, very much closed. But of course, copies were sent down to the provincial level. Every provincial leader had to somehow be kept informed of what was happening. So great amounts of it were made available. And I think myself and a number of other local historians have made very much the best of that opportunity at the time. But even then, there are entire provincial archives that to this day remain pretty much closed. And it also has to be said, I think, that the Cultural Revolution has always been a taboo topic, and that for some odd, bizarre twist, the actual amnesia about the Great Leap Forward has actually resulted in more of the material becoming available in the archives, simply because the people who have to work on the ground in these archives don't necessarily know an awful lot about it. So it seems to be, again, a bit of a gray zone. That's one of the benefits. But my hope, of course, is that these archives will go back to where it was before the Olympics and increase the availability of the material to ordinary citizens and, of course, historians. Let me just add one sentence. If you think the book shows horrendous evidence, bear in mind that this would be based on soft evidence, not the material that still remains classified about that period.
Joshua Rosenzweig. I also have a question about the archives, but more about the conditions in which those archival materials were produced. You suggested that a lot of these were produced after the fact, around 1962, which suggests at least a period of time in which, for some particular reason, there was an effort to document or remember this, and that you also said that this feeds into why the Cultural Revolution happened. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that and how this material that was produced then was either used at the time or how it stopped being used.
I understand the question. It's a very good question, although I misinterpreted the nature of the evidence. Most of the archival material I use dates from 1958 till the end of the catastrophe, 1961. In some cases, there's material that was produced in 1962, 63, 64, but that's a minority. Most of the stuff that's precisely from that period. The one thing you have to bear in mind is that one-party states produce abundant material and tend to keep it. It's very difficult for somebody in any position of power to go back into these archives and take out an incriminating file, if only because many of these files are reproduced many, many times, sometimes at least for five leaders, five people, sometimes up to 150 copies. It's all internally circulated material. That's one thing. The second thing is that the archives contain all sorts of material. It's a rather gray, harsh term, archives, that brings to mind, you know, the historian who plods through this material, but the letters written by ordinary people to complain about what is happening in their own village. There are investigations by the Federation of Women about what happens in factories to women. There are teams that write reports after long and detailed investigations into, say, inundations on the Huyaobang along the river, the Yellow River Basin, in September 1961. The private letters written by Liu Shaoqi up to Mao Zedong. It's extremely profuse and diverse documentation. Now, the key point to bear in mind, if I can push your question a little bit further, the real question is, since so much of that period is based on lies, how do I know that what I find is not based on lies? That's the key question. It has to do with not only the diversity of this material and putting it into its right context, but also fundamentally with the flow of information. Some of it goes up, some of it goes down. When I write up, I lie. I say it's wonderful. But because I lie, I know that the people below me lie too, and I want to find out because my career depends on it. So I have the means to find out. I send my own secretaries. I send my own teams. I lead my own investigations. So it's a double-track system. Here's the head of Hebei province who finds out that in one county alone in his province, up to 15,000 people died of hunger. A week later, he writes to Zhou Enlai to report that a mere 1,000 people suffer of malnutrition in the entire province of Hebei. You lie up, you find out down.
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. I think I'm going to put to you a question that was similar to one, if I recall, it was put to Jasper Becker, when he came here to speak about his book. And that is this. Despite all of this archival information that you have, one thing that seems to be extraordinary in its absence is any lack of photographic record. So many photographers have been at work in China, official photographers, people who have their own little snap cameras, whatever. Somehow, none of this period seems to ever come forward in a graphic way. I'm wondering whether you think that exists, if you have any thoughts on why it doesn't exist. And the second part of my question is simply goes to the question of resistance. One would think if this many people were being routinely killed or allowed to die or forced to die, whatever words one wants to use, and murdered would probably be a fair term, why was there no organized or apparently no organized resistance?
You put your finger on such a crucial point, the lack of photographic evidence. There is enough about the famine in the Ukraine that took place about 30 years earlier to produce a whole documentary on it. Even foreigners were able in the Ukraine, despite every effort by Stalin to keep it secret, there were foreigners able to take photos and films of children dying of hunger in orphanages. And yet nothing on the Great Leap Forward during this period. And it is not for lack of trying. I've tried very hard and I've spoken to a number of people, including one historian who's wonderful called Yu Si Guang, who spent the best part of his personal fortune and his time, 20 years, to look at county archives on the Great Leap Forward. His wife is not happy. He's very obsessed with this period. He's collected massive amounts, and all he ever found was one photo of a cannibal standing next to a child that has been cannibalized. The only one bit of photographic evidence he's been able to uncover. I do think that there is evidence, but I do think that it is so touchy and so explosive that it is either in private hands or it is very safely locked away in those archives. But I cannot believe that there were no photos, simply because corruption being extraordinarily widespread during this period, some people were feasting through famine. One of the first thing any carter would buy was a camera and a bicycle. Point two, your second question. When I have a little bit more time, when I have 40 minutes to talk, I always end with modes of resistance. And there was, to some extent, organized rebellion. Tibet is a very clear example. But for instance, in Xuanwei County, a number of villages, with the support of party secretaries in the higher echelons of power, actually took weapons and rebelled in 1960. And Zhou Enlai had to send in the army to crush it. There are a dozen similar incidents reported just for that one region in 1 year alone. In Hunan province, I believe it was in the winter of 1960, within the space of 2 months in one county alone, some 30 granaries are assaulted out of a total of 500. Sometimes farmers torch them. In one case in Guangdong, they leave behind a message that says, this grain is not ours. We might as well burn it. The levels of violence is extraordinary. So on the one hand, farmers are the victims of violence, but all too often violence begets violence. And that very passive shield that outsiders mistake for passivity or submissiveness breaks down, and people erupt in a blind fury. They will attack carters with cleavers in meetings. And there are also organized forms of theft. For instance, in Gansu province, January 1961, there are 500 assaults on trains reported by the Public Security Bureau. In one case, 4,000 farmers gather by the railway and simply wait for the next freight train to pass by. They assault the entire train and take away every removable portion of property. But ultimately, all these are very isolated acts of resistance and rebellion. Nothing somehow brings it together. Why? Well, I think there is a very good explanation for this. From 1949 to 1957, in the 10 years that precede this catastrophe, every liberty is stripped away. The liberty of association, the liberty of speech, the freedom of religion, the freedom of movement. And once you do that, it becomes very difficult for people to actually act or find any support of that in some form of civil society, in some form of organization outside of the party itself. So only the party had the clout to keep that entire country together. There's another more difficult explanation. At the time, I did mention earlier on that ordinary people write. Well, sometimes they write to Chairman Mao. You find letters that start as such. 亲爱的毛主席,你肯定很忙吧? Now, dear Chairman Mao, you must be very busy. And then the person goes on to explain what is happening. A lot of people on the ground have faith in the chairman. Harking back to an imperial tradition, they believe that the local party officials are wicked, but the emperor, that semi-god called Mao in Beijing, he's actually a good man. And things would be so different if only he knew.
I'm To Hanshi from the South China Morning Post. I know time is short, but could you just briefly go into a little bit of detail about how leaders like Liu Shaoqi and his Mao Zedong's General Peng Dehuai knew about the disaster of the Great Leap Forward, how that affected their interaction with him and their balance of their power vis-a-vis Chairman Mao in those few years?
It's a really good question, and all too often the debate gets polarized around Mao. But what the book shows, thanks to all these wonderfully detailed minutes of meetings and corridor encounters, is how much support Mao actually got from other leaders. How at every crucial moment, others lent him the support that was necessary to push this through. And those who didn't quite toe the line were subjected to extraordinary pressure, including, for instance, number three. Number two, Liu Shaoqi, stood right behind Mao from day one with the Great Leap Forward. He thought that was a really good idea. Number three, Zhou Enlai, was much more circumspect, didn't quite like it. And he was demeaned, debased, undermined by Mao in front of other assembled leaders in a whole series of meetings in the beginning of 1958. He almost collapsed, having to write his self-confession on several occasions. And in the end, Zhou Enlai fell in line, and he did a really good job. After all, here is somebody who has to carry out these orders. Mao is the visionary, but somebody needs to go and get all that grain from those different provinces. Zhou Enlai did it very effectively, sending telegrams, bullying people, forcing them to come up with more and greater procurements to pay back to the Soviet Union. In fact, who was the first one to say, I would rather eat less than not honor foreign commitments when it came to repaying debts to the Soviet Union? Well, that was Zhou Enlai, right away. Although my feeling is when he said, I would rather eat less, he meant let the Chinese people eat less. And he increased procurements with the accord of other top leaders, including Mao. Take more so that we can pay back these debts to the Soviet Union earlier. At all key political moments, Mao Zedong, including at the Lushan Plenum when Peng Dehuai gets criticized in the summer of 1959, at all these crucial moments, Mao is given absolute fundamental support by a whole series of leaders. So he's definitely the one who starts this catastrophe and also the one who stops it by stepping back, but he would never have prevailed without the help of many other leaders. He did step back. Li Fuchun very, very cleverly managed to navigate a change of policy around him. But then, of course, it's also the many, what I now refer to as willing executioners on the ground, the many cadres who were all too willing to step into the shoes of other cadres who got purged in 57, 58, or in the wake of the Lushan Plenum 59. Some 3 million cadres were purged, but the total membership of the party almost doubled. So there were millions of very hard, unscrupulous men willing to benefit from the radical winds blowing from Beijing and willing to carry out these orders at all costs, regardless of what was right and what was wrong.
Are you now allowed back to China after the publication of your book?
I'm waiting for an invitation. I'm sure the current leadership will welcome my effort and all the time I spent to look at this horrendous black heart of the history of the People's Republic of China. But I haven't gone back yet. So we'll see. We'll find out.
I do know we have more questions, but unfortunately we try to keep our commitment to get you out of here at 2 o'clock. So perhaps you can find Frank and ask him some follow-up questions afterwards. But anyway, we want to thank Frank, for an absolutely fascinating talk today.
Thank you. Thank you.
If you have any further questions, don't hesitate to email me. I'd be happy to answer any other questions by email.
Can we have your address?
The address is decotter, no umlaut, 1K, 2 T's, decotter at mac.com. Mac as in Macintosh, mac.com. It's on my website, which is easy to find, frankdecotter.com.
Great, and we have a token of appreciation.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. The last time I spoke at the FTC in Beijing some 10 years ago, I got a lousy T-shirt.
Well, we're trying to keep...